So Ken, storyteller Ken, the story so far that you've told us about the stages of development has been, in my view, sort of the introductory story, but right. I want a more in-depth story right. about the stages of development.
Story 1.0.
Give me point.
Story 2.0.
Yeah.
We started out sort of five components of this, the basic simple integral model. The components are quadrants, levels, lines, states, and types. And we'd sort of gotten through quadrants, levels, lines. We were sort of focusing in on the notion of levels or stages or waves, and particularly as it applies to individuals, but also cultures, and the idea that there can be uneven development, which we call levels and lines, which is that an individual or culture can be highly developed in some lines, medium in other lines, very low in other lines, pathological in certain lines. And you have to kind of take the overall balance sheet or scorecard to get a sense of how well individuals, cultures, societies, and so on are doing. And so far we've been using Carol Gilligan's stage conception for female moral development, which were three simple stages of selfish care and universal care. But at one of the more recent questions you asked about how really getting down and sort of getting more precise about scoring some of the pluses and minuses of modern societies. So at some point we need a little bit more detailed scale. We have to make the map a little bit more detailed in terms of the developmental aspect in order to start getting more kind of more interesting discussions going about what actually is going on out there and what's going wrong with what's going on out there and possible solutions. So one of the ways to do this, we've talked about the fact that research has indicated that there's one dozen or even two dozen developmental lines or intelligences or modules. And we could kind of go through and give actual stages in four or five of those, but that gets really kind of complicated very quickly and boring, and I will fall asleep halfway in the middle of my own presentation, which is extremely embarrassing. So what we can kind of do is just use kind of some generic levels, waves, or stages that we can sort of use to talk about in a general way. And we'll give maybe six or seven stages, but understand that they can apply in a very loose sense to sort of any number of the developmental lines. Although technically, if we went in and looked at the lines, they would be, you know, each have a different terminology and each a little bit different structure and so on. We've already given one six-level conception, and that's Jean Gebser's. Gebser, very famous historian, very widely respected around the world, genius, really. And he developed his scale looking at cultural evolution over epochs, over hundreds and thousands of years. And the general waves or stages of development for him were archaic, magic, mythic, rational, and integral. And that's a good start. We can subdivide a few of those and get just a little bit more granularity in the stages. So what I'm going to do is give, let's say, seven. Sort of correspond with seven chakras if we want to do it that way at some point. And we're going to call them, drum roll, archaic for sort of the first basic wave. And archaic can mean it's just a general catch-all. It can mean all the lower levels kind of leading up to the first specifically sort of human wave of development. And then wave two or stage two is egocentric. We've already looked at this as Gilligan's selfish stage. Stage three is conformist. We've already looked at this as her stage of care. Stage four is rational, formal. It tends to be highly individualistic. Stage five is pluralistic. It tends to be very common in postmodernism and multiculturalism. Stage six we can call integrated or holistic or integral. All of these stages are integrated as far as they can be in their own way. But this stage is particularly important because a lot of researchers from Jane Lovinger to Jean Gebser to Claire Graves has found that this wave is the first stage of development where people actually become self-consciously aware of a holistic or integrated outlook. And it becomes a real desire and need at this stage of development to find a kind of unity or a big picture or holistic overview. So that's going to be our generalized stage six. And then stage seven is going to be just another a loose term for any sort of higher waves or stages that might be up there, and we'll just call that transpersonal. We can talk about that a little bit later as well. The general idea again with, so we have archaic, egocentric, conformist, rational, pluralistic, integral, transpersonal. The general idea where those are in the upper left, but these also reverberate, have their other dimensions in the other quadrants. And so you find in the lower right quadrant, for example, that archaic moving into egocentric, selfish, or magical wave has a social system in the lower right that is foraging. And then you move from foraging into horticultural as you develop mythic, and from horticultural into agrarian for mythic and very high developments in the conformist wave. And then you move into industrial and then informational. So those are the sort of exterior social correlates of these interior waves of consciousness. And we could, again, go around the quadrants and make those kinds of correlations. But we want to stick with these sort of seven chakras, if you will, for individuals. Right now, what's happened in terms, if we look at the lower left or cultural evolution, which is what Jean Gebser sort of got started on, we find that the center of gravity, certainly in the culture we're in, for example, has over 500,000 years evolved from archaic into magic or egocentric, into mythic or conformist, and is somewhere right around the rational, industrial, formal wave of development. Now, of course, individuals in these cultures can be higher or lower. Even in previous epochs, somebody at the magic or egocentric era could still be highly developed individually. But the culture at large had a center of gravity roughly at those waves. One of the things that becomes very interesting then is you can actually start to look at culture wars in this country, or anywhere for that matter, as a real clash of these stages of development, with various individuals and pockets of culture being at different waves in this overall unfolding. And you get some very, very classic paradigm wars, clashes, culture wars going on. And there are three or four of them right now that are really major. We're seeing it with multiculturalism, postmodernism versus modernism, and modernism versus traditionalism. Those three terms, traditionalism, modernism, and postmodernism, actually apply to the conformist wave, the rational wave, and the pluralistic wave. So three very distinctive value structures that give rise to these different sort of cultural movements. And those three cultural movements are at war in this country right now, really, really aggressively, not to mention the world at large. So there are a lot of other things going on in quadrants, states, types, and all of that. But these waves or stages or levels of development are part of the clashes that human beings get into when they run into each other. So that we can kind of use those seven. If we want to talk about levels or stages or waves, we can use that scale of seven general levels to be a little bit more precise about some things we want to talk about.
Okay, just to clarify the terminology on a couple of them. When you're using the words magic to describe the egocentric level and mythic to describe the conventional or conformist, can you explain the use of those two words, magic and mythic?
Yeah, and those are used in a very specific way. And obviously the terms themselves can have a whole lot of different meanings. And so here they use very specifically the way Jean Gebser originally used them and the way a lot of people would still use them. And they're not in... Some magic, for example, means very much a kind of infantile, omnipotent thinking, word magic. It's prevalent in voodoo. The idea is if I manipulate a symbol or a word, it will actually affect the person that it represents. If I stick a pin into a doll representing that person's going to get ill. I've tried that many times and it doesn't work. So that's generally that kind of magical worldview, and it's called egocentric, because the prevalent belief is that my thoughts manipulate the world, that if I think something, I'm actually going to bring it about. I can actually cause it. This is very common in certain types of kind of power magic. And on the one hand, you have to be very careful because there are such things as psychic powers. And so we want to, or paranormal powers, or occasionally some sort of telepathy, precognition, and so on. Those are actual, to the extent that they occur, those are actual real events. Magic is just fantasy. It's pretend. You think you can cause all of this damage in the world, but you really can't. There's also fear of retaliation, that if somebody's giving you the evil eye, that's going to, you know, kill you. It's very superstitious, fetish objects, and so on. And it's egocentric because it really imagines that it can manipulate the world in its own thought. Very common in a two-year-old, three-year-old. You see magic in Saturday morning cartoons, because all the superheroes fly around and they point and they zap people and they, you know, they're omnipotent. They have this extraordinary kind of power, all vested in their own ego. As the infant develops and finds that if he or she is thinking all these magical thoughts and the world doesn't conform, sooner or later magic tends to die down because in reality it just doesn't work that well. At that point, this omnipotent power that you used to have, I can make it rain, I can make the sun come out, I can do that, gets transferred to other figures. It gets transferred to the parents. It gets transferred to imaginary gods and goddesses. Now, all of a sudden, you can't order the world around, but God can. So all of a sudden, sort of these direct rituals get replaced with petitionary prayer. And now if you want something out of the world, you have to pray to the correct god or goddess using the right words in order to get that god or goddess to order the world around for you. So you can no longer smite your enemies just by giving them the evil eye, but God can if you know the right things to say to God. So all these myths kind of come crashing onto the scene, both in history, starting around 10,000 BC, and also in the young child, starting around age 3, 4, 5, 6. And again, we have to distinguish, just as we distinguish magic, which is sort of, if you will, kind of infantile, from psychic, real psychic powers, which are can be highly advanced, highly mature powers. We also have to distinguish the sort of, if you will, childish myth from some form of high archetype or Jungian symbolic occasion or images that carry high spiritual or religious meaning and so on. It's an important distinction. Too many people, though, just believe one or the other of those. They either believe that all mythic images are nothing but childish nonsense, or they tend to believe that all mythic images are nothing but spiritual high icons and images. And it's probably a mixture of both, but certainly for early stages of development, they're taken to be very concrete, very literal. Classic examples are Moses really did part the Red Sea, Jesus really was born from a virgin, and so on.
Moses didn't really part the Red Sea?
No, but Jesus was born from a virgin. I don't want to disagree with that one. I'm covering the bases. Those types of myths tend to dominate, at least in present-day individual development, they tend to dominate consciousness, like I say, from around age 4 or 5 up to around age 8 or 9. And at that point, it's the myth itself, the individual is still checking, was the earth really created in 6 days, is this whole kind of rational approach starts to emerge, sort of a little bit more scientific, if you will. And the idea is, let's check some of these myths out and see if they're really true. At that point, the next general wave that we're talking about starts to emerge. It tends to be rational, tends to be industrious, tends to be scientific. In world history, this sort of mythic wave as an epic that Gene Gebser looked at tend to dominate the world, like say, from around 10,000 BC, certainly through up to early Greek period, and then continued sort of into the Middle Ages. And starting right around the era of the Greeks, and then into the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, this whole sort of rational, scientific, formal approach tended to emerge. And again, it's not formal operational thinking or cognition or rationality. Again, it's not that dry, abstract, linear reasoning. It's a capacity to take other perspectives. It's a capacity to take third-person perspective, to put yourself in other people's shoes, to actually get perspective. And that's why during this period of the Renaissance, for example, in art, you actually see three-dimensional art emerge for the first time. There is no perspective in painting or art prior to that time. If you look at the great Egyptian hieroglyphs or any of the early artwork, it's flat. It's two-dimensional. But right about the time that this next wave of development emerges, you get not only a kind of scientific perspective of experiment and hypothetical-deductive reasoning, you actually get three-dimensional perspective in art and painting. So these are starting to emerge. That tends to come with this general wave of rational scientific awareness. And, of course, also then you get the emergence of the great sciences, Kepler and Galileo around 1600. Eventually you get mechanics, thermodynamics, all the sorts of things that we associate with biology, chemistry, medicine, and so on. You ask originally about magic and myth, as I've taken it kind of into rational, but you sort of get the general idea about those two.